So today on the Music Retail Podcast, I've got Dave Zimmet from Hickey's Music in Ithaca, New York. And Dave has owned this 130-year-old business since the 90s. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about the history of Hickey's Music and key transition points, the kind of things that that they've experienced, what they're currently working on, trials, tribulations, struggles, successes, and then what the future holds. So, Dave, welcome to the Music Retail Podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So I think you are definitely, your business is one of the older businesses that I've interviewed for the podcast, which is going to be really interesting. So give me kind of the kind of Cliff Notes version on how Hickey's Music came to be, because I read the About Us section of your website, which is actually really well written and entertaining. And if people want to really kind of dive into it, that's a good resource to check into it. But you have an interesting and colorful history for Hickey's Music. So talk to me about that.
Well, the store, as far as I've been able to figure out, started by this guy named Joseph Hickey, who learned how to play banjo and ukulele from his sister, who was a nun. And it just started as a little corner music store. And then Ithaca College started a music program. And for many years, the tradition has it that Hickey's was the library for the School of Music. And you know, as they were getting going. And all those music teachers that came through Ithaca developed an allegiance for the store, and particularly in central New York, because it was so, it was such a great resource. I did my master's in Ithaca in the mid 70s. And, you know, it was traditional on Friday afternoon, everybody would go down the hill to Hickey's, cash their check for the beer run, and, you know, spend some time browsing the stacks, and then so created a lot of loyalty. Mm-hmm. The music store went through the normal economic ups and downs of American history. I came to be involved with it when I moved back to Ithaca in the mid 80s. And I had moved back to teach at Ithaca College, to teach repair. And so I started actually subcontracting, doing some work for them and stuff, but I ran my own business for many years. And then as the store was sort of in trouble, and I figured, you know, what the hell? And, mm-hmm. you know, it was too important for it to disappear. And I had just moved my shop from my home into town. And so I put the two together. And then shortly after that, when I made a deal to buy the store, this kid walks into the store and says, "Hey, I hear you're going to buy the store. I'm looking for a job." And that turned out to be Chuck DiPaolo, who is currently my partner, and that's been a great asset. My basis was in repair with, you know, and sort of a BI type of background. Mm-hmm. Hickey's opened this whole world of print music, which I just became enamored with. I used to play in New York, and there was a store there called Patelson's that most people have heard of that were in the classical music world back then. And I had this dream that my store was going to be another Patelson's. Of course, I didn't take into account the fact that there was a city of 8 million people around Patelson's, and I was literally in the cornfield. So I had to alter our aspirations a bit. Mm-hmm. But something happened because we're in Ithaca. A bunch of kids from Cornell came down to visit us, and told us about this thing called the World Wide Web, which we knew nothing about. And they convinced us that we should get a website. And so that was our step into the new age. And it was a option that made something of a Patelson's type store viable, because our customers were not going to be limited to Central New York. And Chuck and I just had a passion for the print end of the business. And so, a lot of our energy was, how do we make this fly? And then going back a little before I had moved into Ithaca, when I was just running my shop, the folks at John Keel Music had come down and convinced me to get into the rental business. And so I went, that's a whole nother story. We had a number of stores, none of which are still around other than John Keel, that were doing the rental business at that time, which I had some better and worse relationships with. But
what time period did you add rentals to the mix?
I think I started doing rentals in probably about 85, 86.
Gotcha.
But that was out of my house. Mm-hmm. And so then when we bought the store, then it became a much more, walk-in type of thing. Previously, I did everything by deliveries. And then eventually we had, at one point, we worked with Wendell Harrison Music, and then we went on our own. And that
you were an affiliate.
We were affiliate. Affiliate with John Keel, and then we were affiliate with Wendell Harrison, and then
we had your own inventory.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And Hickey's, I mean, for a long time, like you guys you were really specializing in print music. I mean, going back to, kind of the early days of it, had based on what I've read, had just a tremendous amount of print inventory. And we're kind of, renowned for that. And website says, shipping stuff all across the country and all across the world, which is actually very interesting, because with one of our stores, which is now our namesake store, Ernie Williamson Music, similar deal. That store, though, is just a young pup, because it started only in 1935, not 1892, like Hickey's did. And but that store also specialized in print music, and back in the early days also records too, but would ship music all over the world as well. Hickey's experienced a pretty significant decline starting around the 70s and print music, and of course that's continued to be a challenge since that time period. What was it in the 70s, do you think, caused a decline in print, and where is print music today for you?
Well, I think that, as I said, the store had stayed in the family, and by 1970, it was being run basically by two people. And they had really pretty much limited it to the local market. They weren't doing any kind of outreach, and if somebody wanted something, they'd get it. And there's just the having the new and upcoming stuff was not part of their mix. They also had thousands of out of date charts on the wall. And so people had sort of gotten bored with looking through the stuff.
That can happen with print.
Yeah. And when we came in, we made a conscious decision that we weren't going to stock band music and orchestra music, large ensemble music. That was not where our interest was. And there were other people that were doing it really well. And what we Yeah, that like, you know, really comes down to where your passion is. And
Right.
we were into solo and ensembles, you know, chamber music type of stuff, and working with teachers and their students. So we certainly tried to make ourselves a viable option for band music, but there was no way without, you know, having specialists to really do that well.
Right. What's your print selection look like today?
It's big. The you know, you probably know we have a real strong presence in the trombone world, and so we have. You always hesitate to say you have everything, but there's pretty. It's very hard for a trombone player to not be able to get what they need from us, and
Just in print
either us.
music or in.
Well, with everything, I mean, that's a we
Gotcha.
do the
Okay.
other stuff too, but you know, we want the trombone teachers to be able to tell their student, oh yeah, call Hickey's, they have it.
Right.
And so as we've well let me back up. So I bought the store and we're trying to figure out how to make this thing fly, and I get a call from the viola teacher at Ithaca College, who says, oh, this is in 91, I think. The International Viola Conference is going to be in Ithaca next month. We'd love for you to exhibit. And we said, okay. Had no idea what doing exhibit meant because we'd never done one. And yeah, so okay, sure. And then we started getting calls from C.F. Peters and from some foreign publishers. Hey, I hear you're going to be there. Can you exhibit our stuff? And so this actually turned Chuck and I onto the idea of, oh, this is how you reach out. This is before the internet, and or slightly before, and so we set up, you know, set up a bunch of tables. We had all this viola music, which we knew nothing about, but we learned quick, and we learned how people that are passionate about their instruments get into the kind of things that they're looking for. And so when there was an international trombone conference, we jumped on that because Chuck's a bass trombone player. And then we've done the trumpet shows and horn shows and double reed shows. And you know, some we'll travel all over the country for, depending on, you know, our market penetration. But no, so trombone, I think we've done every trombone show since we that's been since we started.
Wow.
And so, you know, one of the things, and I suspect for you as well, we really like our customers, and we really like the people that are into making music, and so, you know, we have friends all over that we see maybe once a year or maybe once every 4 or 5 years, but you know, when you're doing a 5-day show, you see these people 3 and 4 times, or five, you know, or maybe more often at the booth, and you develop a relationship, and then that relationship extends through the year when they call or email about, you know, do you have this or can you find this, and you know, for me, that's the most satisfying thing of the job, is you get to meet these people, and you know, some people are just incredible artists, some are incredible people, and there's a few jerks in the mix, but
Sure.
by and large, you know, these are just really great people. And I think we feel the same way about the people that come into the store. You know, they're here because they like what we like,
Right.
and so we enjoy it. So anyway, so doing these shows was a huge step for us. Occasionally, like we, and then we would, you know, we would expand our the depth of our offerings depending on the expertise we had in the store. So we had some trumpet people come in as employees. We started to grow the trumpet department, and brass quintets. So it's been pretty much organic. So we try to have representative stuff in the store for the local Central New York community, and then we in various areas, we try to be representative for the world market.
Gotcha. So it's your specialization for your business then, primarily school music and print. and with some kind of deep specializations into certain niches that have sort of kind of happened organically, especially the trombone market. Is that accurate?
It's sort of accurate. I mean, we, you know, the print music has changed. The market has changed. You know, when we started, the print music was the most, dollar-wise, was the bigger part of our business.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, both have grown, but the print music is not growing anywhere like the BI and the MI end,
gotcha,
end of it are. And, you know, we're part of the school market by virtue of the fact that we do the rentals and we call on schools. But I don't see that as our primary. Personally, I don't see it as our primary. You know,
interesting.
The numbers might say something different.
Right.
But
your primary, is it like the trombone things and that type of deep dive?
My primary is that we're problem solvers, that we try to make people fix it so people can make music.
Right.
Okay. And some of them are students. And I mean, I had a woman the other day who she's in her early 70s and she decided she wanted to play the clarinet. And she, you know, she's really enjoying it, but she's having trouble. And, you know, so we sat down, we talked about, you know, if you use a metronome, this will really help solve. And, you know, it's like the world opened up for her. And it's those little moments, you know, or helping somebody pick out a mouthpiece, or, you know, helping a mom do something with her preschoolers, you know, the it's those moments that really make it fun for me. And right. I think, and I think, you know, the people in the store, whether they're working on the phone or working with people in person, it's like, oh, this person had a problem and I figured out how to fix it for them. And not a problem because we screwed up, which does happen, but a problem because, you know, they have a challenge. And so school music is a piece of it. Local, pop music type stuff is a piece of it. The avocational music maker, you know, we got into selling digital pianos and keyboards and things of that sort. Back when MIDI came, we were like the MIDI specialists. Don't ask me to do anything now with MIDI, but back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I sort of knew my way around it.
Right.
But, you know, so as things happen, we try to stay on top of it. In the beginning, I actually would make the mistake of getting into the new stuff too quickly. Because I'd go to a NAMM show and I'd come back, oh man, this is great.
Right.
And, you know, start purchasing and stuff and then realize, well, it's great, but the market's not here yet. And then by the time the market showed up, all the stuff I had was
right
passe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think we all are just excited about making music and helping people do that.
Gotcha.
So
your building's pretty interesting too. It's you know, had housed many businesses over the years, including kind of a world-renowned clockmaker for a long time. But I was surprised when I saw the pictures of it, which kind of drove me then to go to Google Maps too. So it looks like a very large building. How big is this building that you're in?
I don't know, but we don't take all of it.
Oh, you know? Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We have less than, I would say less than half of it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, so
it was a clock factory at one point, and it's like a factory. It's a huge building, and on Google Maps, when I'm doing the street view, I couldn't see like any other business in there. I'm like, do they have that whole thing?
Yeah, no, we have the front of the building, we have the entire width of the building, and then we go back to the area we call Dilbertville, which is where the people that work on the phones and picking stuff, and then we have a warehouse section. But there are photographers and massage therapists and a gun machinist and a wood shop. I mean, there's a lot of stores. The owner of the building, you know, has just been trying to make use of it, because, you know, we're in a residential section, so you're somewhat limited to the mm-hmm. kinds of things that you can do, but it's a historical structure, and which makes it sort of interesting when you try to do any kind of renovations or
right
or run wires or whatever.
Gotcha. But,
yeah, it looks very impressive when you see the size of the building. It's
like, yeah,
wow, it's the store, man, you know.
Yeah, the old photos and everything. Like, it's like, wow, that's significant.
Yeah.
So what kind of things are you all working on currently at Hickey's?
We're trying to figure out how to compete in a market and still keep a personal approach to the product, you know, so that, you know, to sell enough product to stay open and have enough stuff on the floor that has as much stuff on the floor that we do, we have to sell a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we also want to make sure that at least somebody in the store knows what it is. And
that's a good idea. You know, so,
it's like you think of internet things and internet market, and you know, we do answer the phone and we do answer questions about product, because, you know, we'll go out and find it and say, oh yeah, if you look it on the back, there's the but it's getting harder and harder as the margins get thinner, and mm-hmm. And right now, I think the big thing is we're still trying to recover from the supply chain issues from the, I still have POs open from 90, you know, for stuff that they come, oh yeah, it's going to come. We're just having supply issues. Yeah, when we get off camera, we can talk about, do you have any?
we can trade some inventory back and forth.
Yeah, right. Okay. But the big challenge for me is that I'm going to retire. And my partner, Chuck, is going to take over the store. And the challenge is, how do I not do what I'm doing, both personally and, you know, who do we task in the store to take over the stuff? Because mm-hmm. I'd like to think what I do is important.
What do you do? What does your day to day look like?
Well, there's that email correspondence and text correspondence and podium correspondence that takes up a fair amount of the day.
So you handle that personally?
No, we all handle it, but I do a fair amount of it.
Okay. Gotcha.
I do the hard buying as far as hard goods, Chuck, and now actually he's turned that over to Peter and Lee to do the print buying, but I'm doing the instrument accessories and stuff, and that's sort of a daily thing as we're trying to keep track of inventory and make sure that we have stuff on the shelf. Dealing with the, I don't know if you found this, we're getting so much more pushed at us by the manufacturers, whether it's changes in mat pricing or temporary mat suspensions or, policy changes.
Yes.
And okay, now we're going to have a buy, and this buy is only open for 7 days. Well, you know, I've got other stuff planned for these 7 days.
Right.
So, it just seems to me that there's been a huge jump in the amount of stuff that the manufacturers are expecting us to deal with from that perspective, which, if all you're doing is selling boxes, is not a big deal. But if you're, if your focus is not on the selling the boxes part, but on dealing with the product and knowing about the product and dealing with people, At least in our organization, we don't have anybody that's just dealing with, you know, how many boxes and what price to put on it. Somebody else has to add that onto their job. Right. And so that is, you know, that right now is currently our biggest challenge. You know, it's like I have a vendor that I sell maybe 20 SKUs from, and I missed a price update. And in that price update, 15 of the SKUs we sell were discontinued. And, you know, so, you know, after the fact, I got that and, you know, stuck that all in there. But one of the things that, you know, if I had to do this all over again, I would probably create a third category of management, which would be more of a operating officer. Mm-hmm. To deal with those nuts and bolts stuff, whether it's, you know, dealing with the marketing or dealing with the price changes and the map. And
your current management structure, is it finance and sales and marketing? Is that kind of the way you've got it set up then? How are you currently set up?
Okay. Yeah. So Chuck and I are partners. I deal with the vendor relationships and the finance end of it. Chuck deals with the website and the policy end of it. But I've got very active employees, and I'm happy to say that, you know, since I've announced that I'm going to be retiring, they've been stepping up and taking over more and more responsibilities. And again, this was a mistake I think I made in the very beginning, is that I didn't trust anybody and tried to do everything myself.
Yeah, I'm really surprised to hear, you know, as long as you've been there, and with, like, you know, the revenues and things like that you're doing, that you're still handling the purchasing. That
it's pretty stupid.
I even wrote that down. Like, I was like, wow, that's interesting. I think that's one of the first things probably most business owners offload. Why did you keep a handle on it? Because you felt like you had such specialized acquired knowledge from participating in all these shows and your relationships and so on and so forth. And you,
yes, because it's easier to do it. I'm irreplaceable. So it's, I really enjoy it. It's fun to see what's selling and what, you know, and then, you know, I'm dealing with the vendors, so I know this deal's coming up, and, you know, are you a consumer dealer? You know, mm-hmm. about these incentive things they got going on, and, you know, but yeah, I mean, I think that was a mistake. I should have gotten out of that. But I didn't. But now I have to train some other people.
You're getting out of it now?
Yeah. I better train quickly, right? But again, you know, these relationships, I've got people on the other end of the phone that I've been talking to for, you know, some cases, 35 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, our conversations are short, but they're meaningful. And I'm going to miss those.
Right.
I'm going to miss those. I do a lot of pressing the flesh, you know, going to the shows, of course, but local teachers and, you know, my repair background gives me a certain expertise that commands some respect. When they ask me a question about an instrument, they know if I give them an answer that it's not going to be a made up one.
Right.
There's a lot of times I have to go find information, so yeah, you asked me what my day is. So right now my day is mostly responding to emails and vendor issues and trying to figure out how to keep moving.
Right. When's your retirement date set for?
January 1.
Gotcha. So, I mean, as of this point, you're 2.5 months away. Basically.
Yeah. Which is like, how the hell did that
happen? How old is Chuck?
Chuck's 10 years old. He's in his 50s.
Okay.
I think he's in his 50s. I don't know. It's like, I think so. You'll have to ask him.
Right. How many employees are at Hickey's?
I think we're at around 15 now.
Okay.
When I announced my retirement over the summer, then we started bringing in, I should say Chuck started bringing in some people to pick up. And then we've had some turnover with people leaving town and stuff. So there's been a lot of new training going on.
Yeah. I bet. So most experts agree that we are going to be entering into a recession, likely happening sometime in 2023. I think it's nearly unanimous, the prediction for this. What isn't unanimous, of course, is maybe the severity of it. Some people think it's going to be, the last thing I heard was 2/3 of CEOs that were polled thought it was going to be significant, you know, like the 2008 recession or something like that. Other people thought it would be just something kind of small. So that kind of remains to be seen. But Hickey's has been through many recessions before. What using that to kind of guide you, how is Hickey's preparing for this looming recession that we're dealing with now?
Well, in a business like ours, you've got inventory and labor. And the $64 question is how much inventory should we have? And I'm going to, the previous recessions we've weathered because we've always been sort of shoestring anyway. I'm more hesitant to invest in new product now. This is coming on the recovery from the pandemic. And I think the pandemic was much more of a challenge than this recession is going to be, unless we have mass layoffs. And being in an educational town, I don't think we're going to see mass layoffs in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean the rest of the world's not going to suffer. So I've been watching the news and not expecting that it's going to make a huge change in our day-to-day activity, but it is affecting my willingness to invest in to expose myself to debt,
I guess. Right.
We've gone through some, you know, pretty tough times over the 40 years I've been here, or 34, 40 years when you count before I bought Hickey's. We've survived them all. I'm not concerned about our being able to weather it. And we're not leveraged. So that relieves a lot. I mean, we have been in the past, but right now we're not leveraged other than our accounts payable. So,
right.
I think we're in pretty good shape.
Well, that's obviously a great way to recession proof your business, is to not be leveraged.
Our rental season this year has been unbelievable. Mm-hmm. If that can continue without me having to buy a hell of a lot more horns, then that's going to be a good mainstay.
Yeah, I think that's one of the nice things about our industry, is that I wouldn't say that we're recession proof, but you know, historically, when there is a recession and things get tight kind of financially, people do decide to make that investment in music because they think it's more of a permanent, lifelong goal and something worth investing in, more than maybe some of the experience type things that they will do, like maybe travel or dining, possibly even like video games or something like that. So I feel like that's kind of helped us. Matter of fact, I saw one of my employees sent me a screenshot of an ad on one of the social media platforms that what's the franchised music store company that does all the used mainly used
Music Around. Yeah.
No, but Music Around is putting ads out, you know, for people that they can buy franchises and start their own music store because it's a recession-proof business. And like, I wouldn't call it recession-proof, but like, it's certainly we have our advantages. And like,
well, I think the average ticket for in a music store is a lot less than a trip to Hawaii.
That's true. That is definitely true. Yeah, that is definitely true. Yeah, I agreed. So you've had a long career in the music industry. Who have you admired along the way? Are there people that stand out of people that kind of like, you know, helped you out either, you know, officially as a mentor or unofficially, or just key relationships that kind of showed you the way or anything like that? Anyone stand out?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I'm part of a skull group that calls itself the Big Eight, and I was in another one before that, and those relationships of dealing with vendors that are in the same boat as you and are trusting and willing to share with you. You know, one of my oldest relationships is with Mike White. And when I worked for Curlin Salzman Music in El Paso for 5 years and got to know him then. And, you know, he's like a bad penny. He keeps showing up. We're in this Big Eight group together. And then the folks at John Keel Music have been good. And then I had a very close friend, Sheldon Canis, who was a repair tech at Portman's Music. And Sheldon's passed away, but he was always somebody I could call, and he'd give me a rather blunt assessment of whatever. You know, I try to take from it. I mean, there's a guy named Steve Dillon who you might want to talk to sometime. And Steve and I got to know each other doing these trombone shows. And you know, he's got a whole different view of the world than I do. But we really enjoy, you know, batting these ideas around. I'm sure I'm missing some, you know, leaving out some people that have had a huge impact. Hans Meinig, who was my first repair teacher. And he wasn't a teacher. He was a repair tech in Philadelphia that did, you know, all the high end work for decades. And I would go down and I would just sit, you know, sit by him and watch and listen and see the respect that his clients gave him. And that sort of set, for me, in my mind, is set this, you know, set the bar, mm-hmm. where, you know, I wanted to have that, you know, that kind of credibility. So, we don't live in a vacuum, and I just, you know, I think that, you know, I was a player and a repair tech, and then I got into business. So I think if I had had a real business mentor, that would have given me some, I would have avoided some headaches. I did have, I did work with the Friedman Group for Glenn Ingles came in and, you know, did things of that sort, which I think really helped the business.
Friedman as an Alan Friedman, the accountant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so that really jumped us from the, you know, musicians trying, you know, pretending to be businessmen to, oh yeah, this is what you need to look at.
Right.
And then, and, but, I just never was really interested in the business end as much as the people end.
Right.
And I think that slowed down the progress of the store because we weren't looking at the right things.
So tell me more about that.
About the slowing, that not looking at the right things.
Yeah. You're not looking at the right, what kind of things were you not looking at?
Well, let me rephrase that. I looked at it, but I didn't like it. So turns. Okay. You need to have turns.
That's why I don't look in the mirror. One of my favorite times.
Social media all the time. What are you talking about?
One of my favorite things about the house we live in, we first moved in, the previous owners, it was a foreclosure, had basically taken like everything that they could possibly take, including all the mirrors, which is a little weird to live in a house without any mirrors. But I actually kind of quickly got accustomed to it and loved it. And then, but my wife insisted, of course, we have to have mirrors back in the bathroom again. And so we put these huge mirrors in, and now you can see them as soon as you step out of the shower. And let me tell you, it's a revolting way, a very undignified way to start your
morning. If you weren't awake, then you are, right?
Yeah, I'd have to look at myself naked like that in these mirrors. Like I missed the days when we didn't have them. So, but turns, you didn't like what you saw. So let's get back to, get me back on track here.
So we said years and years ago, we said, well, if we don't sell four in a year, we probably shouldn't sell it. And that actually is still our benchmark. But I want this. I want to have this in the store. And so looking at the numbers and how it changes when you're more careful with your inventory, mm-hmm. does make a difference. And as you talk about the recession thing, to jump ahead again. So for example, with Conn-Selmer, you know, we buy now and we pay in the fall. Mm-hmm. Other vendors do that too, but I just did my Conn-Selmer, so it's fresh in my mind. And so you always worry, okay, you know, what's it going to be like in September when this thing comes, when this thing comes due? And given that there's talk about a recession, I'm being a little bit more hesitant on the big ticket items. The small stuff I know I'm going to sell. You know, I'm going to sell 20 of these mouthpieces and 30 of this and, you know, umpteen of that. So I'm not worried about that. But the trombones, you know, we love trombone. So we have shelves and shelves of trombones. And we're starting to see that some of those trombones aren't selling as fast as we'd like mm-hmm. them to sell. And mm-hmm. And I think that 20 years ago, I wouldn't have paid too much attention to that. You know, just, well, you got to have it. And now it's like, we'd like to have it, but, you know, we probably would rather put that money somewhere where we're going to sell four of them a year.
Right.
So those are the kind of numbers. I mean, one of our biggest deficits is marketing. We've got our website. We've got a subscription to Constant Contact. I can't tell you the last time we sent out a thing. You know, we have, I've been going through some other files and I'm finding all these, and we used to send out these cute postcards with promotions, and, you know, we used to do all this kind of stuff, and we're not doing it anymore. So, you know, what would happen if we started, you know, actively doing that? Are you going to be quiet or do you have to leave? Okay. And getting back to what I was saying before, I'm going to take a pause and
sure.
take the bird out.
You got it.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking about marketing. Let's see here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I hate marketing. I just hate it. And when I have somebody that likes it in on staff, then we do it. But it always seems to fall to the bottom of the to-do list of, you know,
right,
of all the things that have to happen. And that's probably a mistake. That's probably a mistake, particularly when you see how many things people are being hit with. And the fact that I resent getting hit with that stuff from other vendors, I think influences my reluctance to jump on that bandwagon. What do you guys do?
Like you, we do a shit job with it. we're not consistent. Unlike you, I have an employee that his job is to do marketing, and it's uh-huh. Still doing great at it. And his defense too, he also does like he's kind of our main go-to guy for hiring and training, especially salespeople and managers. So he often does other pieces, not just the marketing piece. But I'm constantly reminded that you know, email marketing is still one of the best bangs for your buck that you should be doing. And I get various people that remind me of that, but we don't do a great job with it. And I think the only time I enjoy marketing is when I remind myself that this is my chance to talk to my customer and to not think of my customers as this big monolithic group, but really like to picture them as a person. Mm-hmm. And I have another business that I started almost, I guess, about 15 years ago now, that's now merged into Ernie Williamson Music, but it's a specialty electric bass retail business, online only. And the way I market that business is a website and then a lot of videos, a lot of video content. And I take a lot of lessons from that and try to apply them over to the main company. and sometimes I forget to really push those things through. But definitely when I do like these bass, the people come to me not because I'm like the world's greatest bass player, but they come to me because I think they feel like they know me. And when I do these videos, I'm literally thinking of talking to me. I'm talking to me, the bass player who's watching this video. And when I'm looking at my camera and seeing me, I'm talking to myself, and not just all monolithic bass customers. And it's very personal, and I don't mind bringing in my family or the dog or whatever. In my background, I often will have, I basically have my bar in my background. And so people will kind of comment on that. But it's definitely a different feel than what you'd find from, you know, Sweetwater or something like that. And it's been very successful. I work with three bass brands, and two of them, I'm their number one dealer in the world. Wow. So like I'm moving a lot of product from that, and I really love it. And our conversation today and some conversations I've had over the last week or two has just reminded me, like, I need to take those lessons that I'm learning in my little bass lab and apply it over to this really big gold mine that I'm working on in my day job, you know, because that's
right.
really, I mean,
Right.
the base business makes pretty good money actually. But the real money is made at Ernie Leamson. And
so to continue that though, clearly the marketing for the base business is paying off.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make your decisions about the cost of the marketing for Ernie Williamson? So I think videos are a great, great tool. But you know, it's like, what part of our resources do we put towards that? And I'm just very cheap. you know, I'm so unsure of what the return on the investment is going to be.
Yeah, I can be frugal too. You know, I think, you know, it's actually even over the last week, and I even wrote a few couple things down during our conversation today. You know, I definitely would like us to set up an email automation program and really use that, because with technology today, you can have a whole series of emails that once you add a customer's email to your email database, that they all of a sudden start getting this schedule of emails. It's very simple and affordable to do. I think the key, what I want to work on when we work on these emails, is not to do the same type of transactional sale email that everyone gets. Because like you, I generally hate getting that stuff. I get so much email already that I'm a ruthless unsubscriber. I unsubscribe from so many things. But I do subscribe to certain things, but I subscribe to those things that provide value. And that I think is the key and real value. So I think about my subscriptions. I've got a weekly Monday morning memo from the Wizard Academy that I get, which is an advertising marketing thing. I have the guy who wrote the Habits book, the Atomic Habits book. He has a tremendous email thing that's very thought provoking and very interesting. So I subscribe to some of those kind of things because they add value. I basically don't stay subscribed to any type of sale thing. This week I was looking for some golf stuff and go to their websites and subscribe and you'll save 10% or whatever. I'd subscribe just long enough to get the deal. And then once I was done, I'd unsubscribe, you know, because I don't want to get their plethora of sale emails and stuff like that. So if I want to talk to myself, if I'm trying to find myself as a customer, which may or may not be a good strategy for businesses, it depends. I need to make sure that I'm really providing value in that. And on the video side, frankly, the cost for video today is so small. I use a light kit I've bought off Amazon that I think is $100 or whatever. I use my cell phone and a mount. Of course, today with how popular TikTok is, it's actually better to not use a mount. TikTok is best to hold the phone this way, so you get a little bit of, like, you know, natural movement, because that's the platform. And so I find it very effective to do, or cost effective to do. The problem we have, and I, you know, I'm hoping that our marketing person doesn't feel like I'm throwing him under the bus, because I'm certainly don't mean to. And he and I have had a long 20-year history together, but that he's not personally very involved in social media. So he doesn't like participate much in it. And so sometimes I feel like our content kind of misses the mark because he may not be familiar with the platform. TikTok is a good example. We're putting effort into making TikTok videos.
This is the one I haven't even looked at yet.
Okay. But TikTok's fascinating. I
certainly see a lot of peripheral stuff about it.
Yeah.
It's just been afraid to jump into another.
Genius algorithm. You know, it does a great job of curating content that you're interested in and will serve it to you. But there's a lot of trends and things like that kind of happen on TikTok. And there's kind of like a style for TikTok. And if you're not the kind of person who's spent an hour or 2 hours a day watching TikTok, especially during the pandemic, you may not be really aware of it. And so you just do like other videos. And sometimes I feel like you either miss out. It's not so much that they don't fit the vibe for TikTok, but you're missing stuff. You're missing when there's a trend happening that you can kind of pull people in, and that TikTok will serve that trend up a lot. And so we miss that kind of stuff, which I'd like to see us do. But the other thing that I still like, even though it's difficult, I think now to build a YouTube audience, but YouTube is great for more kind of long tail type things. If you're going to stock a, we've talked so much about trombones, let's keep that going. You're going to stock a Con 88H trombone. Well, you can put some time and effort into doing, you know, a few videos on that instrument. And that Con 88H trombone has been a good seller since its inception, basically. And if someone finds your YouTube video from 7 years ago about the Con 88H with a link to your website, it could result in a sale today. And so YouTube's great for that. It's not really great unless you have a big audience for maybe like print music for the pop hits for 2022 or whatever, things that are really short term. But that's where things like TikTok, Facebook, YouTube Shorts, maybe Instagram Reels, I think those tend to do better there. But as you said, you have to have someone, I think, that really gets into that and is personally involved and invested in that. But I do think the marketing side of it's important. I'm with you in that it's our two key failures in the 20 years I've been here has been marketing. We're not great at tooting our own horn, and we're not great at doing it consistently. And also our website has just been atrocious. And I've spent all kinds of money and all kinds of time to try to not be terrible at it, but it's still terrible. And we're trying it once again. And I've actually got some optimism this time, but I've been optimistic before and been let down. So our website is so bad that it is.
I mean, we're using really old technology at this point, and it's doing the job for us, but it's a balancing act. You know, so where am I going to put my energy? Where am I going to put my money? I've spent a lot of money that never has come to fruition, just like, you know, in that. And yep. It's frustrating.
It really is. I mean, you know, over the years,
they promise you the world. And
yes. Well, and what's funny is the other day my wife was making me sort out some papers in a file cabinet we had at home. And in it, I found my original employment contract that the previous owner had made for me when I first started here 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And I had an employment contract because he moved me from Oklahoma to here. And you know, I was uprooting my family and all that. It's kind of a big deal. So we had an employment contract, and in it, there was a bunch of goals and objectives, you know, growing the rental program, growing sales, and so on and so forth. I had hit all those things in that calendar year. I achieved all those things, but the last thing that was on there was to develop an e-commerce website. And I thought, man, it's been 20 years and I've still failed at that goal. And it's super frustrating. And we in the early days, multiple iterations that we've done of this, we would try to kind of do it on the cheap. And, I'd find like the cheapest kind of way to do it. And because I just didn't think, in the aughts that I'd have a lot of local customers that would care about it. And I didn't think we would, you know, national customers would know who we were. So I just didn't want to spend a lot of money on it. And the results showed. We'd have maybe good looking billboard sites, but they weren't useful for e-commerce. And then we had a couple of runs at e-commerce, but we didn't have the staff dedicated to it. Didn't work. Well, when I bought the business, I decided, like, you know what, like, I'm going to put the money into this. Like, we're going to build a competitive, really good e-commerce site, and I'm not going to be cheap. So I went out and hired a developer that has worked for some big companies, Florida State University, JBL, and spent tens of thousands of dollars on a website that frankly is garbage. Can't even process orders on it. Like, it's so I feel a little bit snake bit about it. And I'm so frustrated with it that last Christmas Eve, I got Joel Minchie agreed to do a quick meeting with me, and I kind of went through just some of my frustrations, and he helped me out quite a bit, gave me a reference for the developer we're using now. So if this developer ends up working out and I end up getting this e-commerce site, then I'll readily share their information with other folks, because it's been such a struggle. But I do think that for us going forward, our email marketing, likely some kind of text marketing is still relevant to some degree for customers that opt in. Video marketing is without a doubt like here to stay, and you got to have a good website. So for us, we're trying to put our effort, our future efforts into those things.
Yeah.
And then, I guess that's going to be Chuck's responsibility.
And then in the meantime, run a music store, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's one thing that I'm really fortunate. I've got a team of people that really help me run it. And my job is to kind of chart a path forward and to kind of push us forward. I don't have a lot of day-to-day responsibilities that are really all that important. You know, hold the leadership team accountable and stuff like that. But certainly if I could take off for a month and this business will run very, very well. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And I'm very fortunate to have people in leadership positions that, you know, to me, I treat them like partners, basically, that have a lot of investment involvement in the areas they run and oftentimes run it like they own it, which I'm grateful for. And, but I never wanted to have to feel like that I had to be here all the time. And, you know, I like the variety of getting to work on new problems and challenges and stuff like that. So I kind of quickly got out. And frankly, I'm just not as invested or as good at some of the things. Like the guy that does our purchasing, Donnie Kraft, just does a great job with it. And he has worked tirelessly with the folks over at Tritech to make significant improvements to the software for version 12. And there's so many little features that people may see that are coming out that are solely his ideas of talking to their support team and development team about, you know, how something should function. And he's just so invested in it. And he's done such a great job of keeping us stocked during this recession during the pandemic. Yeah. We've had supply issues here and there, but really nothing significant. And generally, he's always been able to find a substitute or something like that. So having people like that to be able to just, you know.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And it makes it fun. It's, I mean, these are the people why I come to work every day. You know, I come to work because I want to see what Donnie's working on. I come to work because I want to hear about Misty's successes with the lesson program. I come to work because I want to hear what problems Amanda's uncovered and how she's already fixed them. And, you know, these are all the reasons why I come into the office, you know, want to see what's happening.
Your lesson program back up and running now? Or yes. Did you not shut down?
We went virtual. And we're still doing some virtual lessons today, but the program is back, which I'm really excited about. And I know Misty Kristek, who's our VP of Education, she has worked tirelessly to get this program back. And obviously there for a while, it was just clear, like, okay, like we're going to take our focus off lessons because it's just a sinking ship at this moment, you know, during the pandemic. Right. Shift to virtual when we can, but just like, it's just an area that's, we didn't feel like was worth putting our time into at that point. There was other opportunities to work on. But then when things started to turn around and we could see like, okay, it's, you know, we can bring the program back. Customers are wanting this again. Then you had the challenge of getting teachers and staffing. And she has done a really nice job. Misty and our store managers together have done a really nice job of finding teachers and getting them back on board. So our lesson program is back. Which is great. And like you, we had a record rental season the last 2 years. So it's been really great to see that too.
Neat.
So last couple of questions here. Talk to me about maybe one of the biggest challenges that you've dealt with at Hickey's and how did you overcome it?
Well, on a personal level, it was not taking responsibility for everything. So, yes, the buck stops here, but doesn't mean I have to do everything.
Right.
And that's something I still struggle with. But you know, having good people makes it a lot easier. But if I had pushed myself to trust those people sooner, I think it would made for a much different experience. the biggest challenge. In the early days of ownership, money was a real problem, you know, and figuring out how to finance and be leveraged and meet responsibilities and stuff was a huge, mm-hmm. huge challenge. And I pulled out all the stops to make it work. And you know, fortunately it did. Other than that, I mean, all these things are challenges, but you know, the beginning of the pandemic was a challenge, and you know, we worked together and we figured out how to do it and we survived. And you know, I think that that's, you know, that's part of what makes living and the business and but life in general makes it worthwhile. It's like, okay, I got this problem. I'm going to fix it. And you fix it. And they said, hey, yeah, cool. We did it. And, you know, not too many people were left on the roadside. So that makes it even better. So, yeah, I, you know, nothing just leaps out at me other than my own personal failings. you know, it's, did I make a note on that? Let's see. Yeah, the I would say generally, you know, you have business decisions and personal desires, and when the business decision requires you to take a stand against the personal relationship, that's tough. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, you say, well, it's nothing personal, but it's, you know, those are hard decisions to make.
Yeah,
and certainly the least pleasurable part of the job. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too often, but
right.
But when it does, it's causes a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah, I feel like it's, even if it's nothing personal, it's always personal.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're dealing with people, so it can't help but be personal.
Yeah. But again, going back to what I said in the beginning, you know, fortunately, most of the people in this business are pretty decent.
Yeah.
At least the people that I've run into.
I totally agree. Totally agree. Yeah. So tell me about a negative situation you've experienced in your career that ultimately ended up having a positive outcome or positive effect, but you never want to repeat it again.
Getting into the rental business.
That is a challenging elephant to tackle for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that was a combination of personal business conflict, you know, conflicts. And it was a whole, I mean, I got into the rental business and I was basically a 1.5 man show. And, you know, and I was the typical repairman, I was always behind anyway as a repair tech. And then all of a sudden I had to deal with this other thing on top of it. And it was like, oh, what the hell did I do?
Right.
But I came out on the other side of it. And, you know, it's certainly not the biggest part of our business, but it's a mark, you know, it's a measurable part of our business.
Yeah.
And it's a great form of cash flow. And it, I mean, I used to call on schools and all I was doing was picking up and delivering repairs. And now I'm picking up and delivering repairs, but I'm also picking up and delivering rentals.
Right.
And then that opens the doors for other purchases with the schools and stuff. So, I mean, it's turned out to be a real important thing for the business, but I suffered a lot in the beginning.
It's a tough business. I mean, getting into the rentals, certainly like once it's, you've got it established and everything else, it's very meaningful in terms of revenue and profitability. But, you know, the forecasting that's required is very complicated and difficult, and you've got to just have good intuition and you're going to get lucky and unlucky as you do it. The cash flow required for it is significant. And I think that's what a lot of people, when they, you know, express interest in. It's like, boy, you got to be prepared.
They underestimate what, you know, what's involved.
Yeah. I remember when I used to do all of our ordering for band seasons, and we were growing our school music so fast, you know, the previous owner was concerned that I was going to grow us out of business because the cash demands to purchase the inventory were outpacing with the revenue that was being brought in by the rentals. You know, you back then you'd maybe average wholesale cost to be $300 for a rental your average rental instrument, but it would rent out for $25 or $30 a month. And, you know, you've got 3 months to pay it at the end of the year, but you've only collected 2 or 3 months worth of rent on the instruments. You've collected less than $100. You're paying $300 for it. Like, it doesn't take much of that to create a severe cash flow crunch. And unless you've got significant profits from elsewhere inside the business, it can make it very, very challenging. And like you, when I first got into this, I didn't really know any of that stuff. You know, yeah. I remember my interview with Lee, the previous owner. We would sit down and I met with him, and I also met with his with a CPA. It wasn't his CPA, but it was a local CPA. And they would sit and talk to me about, like, you know, profitability and inventory turns and cash flow. And I would, like, oh yeah, cash flow, lifeblood of every business. I had no idea what any of it meant, really. Like, I knew what profit margin was. That was about all I knew. I didn't know anything about turns or anything else. I just kind of bullshitted my way through it, and then went to the library and got a book, because this is pre-Google. Yeah. So I had to go figure out what all these things meant. And then, you know, like you had mentioned, discovered Alan Friedman through NAMM, and went to every seminar he would do. Even if I'd heard it 10 times, I'd still go, because I
always picked something up. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I felt like I always learned something new. And Alan just has a knack for making something that can be complicated, like financials, make it understandable and entertaining at the same time. Right. And then several, I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we had the pleasure to actually use Friedman Cannenberg as our accountant, which has been helpful as well. But I think through that, I ended up becoming pretty adept at the finance side of it. I've got a good head for numbers and stuff, and, you know, kind of enjoyed it. But now the person we have that handles all that for us internally, Amanda Reuter, she's just, you know, she's one of the smartest people I know, and has just done, she's got formal training in it. And she's just done such a better job with all the stuff.
It's so delightful when you have somebody that actually knows what they're doing.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it really, really is. You know, and it makes it delightful. Like you said, that's the perfect word for it. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So, final question: if you could send a message to a younger you, what would you say?
Find a mentor. You know, and you know, the skull groups are great, but if you can find a mentor, I mean, I would do skull groups also, but and I don't know that it necessarily even has to be in the music business, but it would certainly be helpful for work. Mm-hmm. You know, to keep you focused, I think, you know, having someone there just to touch base with and ask you the question of why are you doing this,
right?
I think would be the number one thing.
Yeah,
because I think so many of us get into this business because it's sort of an avocation gone commercial, and we don't really know why we're doing it until it's either too late. or you know, you run into somebody like Friedman and he sort of like kicks you in the butt.
Yeah.
But you know, if you can start answering those questions earlier, I think you end up in a better place.
And you have friends and allies and partners along the way.
Oh, yeah.
And relationships, yeah. Which is, you know, something you've talked about a lot today.
Well, yeah. We didn't talk about RPMDA and NASMD and, you know, all of these other organizations, which, again, you know, they've all created openings and mini mentorships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you find somebody at one of these conferences that knows what you're looking for. And you glom onto them to much of their regret, but you know, you come away with stuff that solves problems, and it's really valuable.
I've been so fortunate to have several mentors over my career that without a doubt, I would not be where I am today without those mentors, without NAM. So I'm very grateful for that. And I'm honored the last couple of years I've been able to be a mentor through the NAMYP program. And I find it so rewarding to share what I've learned. And I understand now why people like Chuck Averwater and George Hines and just other mentors I've had, I understand now why they were willing to help some dumb kid out of Missouri, because it feels not only does it feel good to give back and help somebody who will wants to help themselves, you know, someone who will do the work. You just feel great in your heart for doing that. It's also really nice. As a mentor, it gives you an opportunity to reflect on the successes you've had, because I'm the type of person I often, you know, focus on what's wrong. And I think a lot of business owners are that way. We find what's wrong and we set about fixing it. We rarely think about what we've accomplished or what's right.
I think that's general musicians as well. You know,
that's probably true.
You know, it's like, I got to fix that. I got to fix that. Yeah.
But when you work with someone that you're mentoring, you know, a lot of the challenges they deal with are things that you have already met and addressed previously in your career. And so to be able to share that wisdom with someone and help someone else through that, just helps you to realize, like, gosh, I have done a lot and know a lot about what I'm doing. Like, I forget that sometimes because I'm so focused on my poor marketing and my crappy website that I forget that I actually am pretty knowledgeable in a lot of other things because I've just done this for so long, you know. And I've cared about it and I've been invested in it, and so I find that to be super useful. And I would encourage anybody, really, regardless of age, to go find a mentor. And if you're, you know, just getting started out, my son has worked in the company for about a year, doing a great job as a salesperson. He's got a mentor right now through NAMYP. They are kind of piloting a junior mentor program for him. He's 21. Steven Olson from Blues Angel Music is his mentor. And I think that's going great. If you're, you know, under 40 to be a NAMYP member, you can totally sign up for their mentorship program there, which is great. But if you're over 40 and still got things to learn, or maybe just need to be re-inspired, maybe you're feeling burned out or tired or worn out or whatever, finding a mentor or a coach or a group or something that is positive and will kind of help you reignite those fires, I think is time and money well spent.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then someday you can retire. Or at least die doing what you love.
Yeah, right.